You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews. First, a new conversation with best-selling author Dean Koontz, whose new suspense series features FBI agent gone rogue, Jane Hawk. We discuss The Silent Corner, which is the first book in that series, published by Bantam. When he was a senior in college, Dean Koontz won an Atlantic Monthly fiction competition, and he has been writing ever since. His books are published in 38 languages, and he has sold over 450 million copies to date. 14 of his novels have risen to number one on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list, making him one of only a dozen writers ever to have achieved that milestone. 16 of his books have risen to the number one position in paperback. His books have also been major bestsellers in countries as diverse as Japan and Sweden. The New York Times has called his writing psychologically complex, masterly, and satisfying. The New Orleans Times-Picayune said Koontz is at times lyrical, without ever being naive or romantic. He creates a grotesque world, much like that of Flannery O'Connor or Walker Percy, a scary, worthwhile reading. Rolling Stone has hailed him as America's most popular suspense novelist. Dean Koontz was born and raised in Pennsylvania. He graduated from Shippensburg State College, now Shippensburg University, and his first job after graduation was with the Appalachian Poverty Program, where he was expected to counsel and tutor underprivileged children on a one-to-one basis. His first day on the job, he discovered that the previous occupier of his position had been beaten up by the very kids he had been trying to help and had landed in the hospital for several weeks. The following year was filled with challenge but also tension, and Koontz was more highly motivated than ever to build a career as a writer. He wrote nights and weekends, which he continued to do after leaving the poverty program and going to work as an English teacher in a suburban school district outside Harrisburg. After a year and a half in that position, his wife Gerda made him an offer he couldn't refuse. "I will support you for 5 years," she said, "and if you can't make it as a writer in that time, you'll never make it." By the end of those 5 years, Gerda had quit her job to run the business end of her husband's writing career. Dean Koontz lives in Southern California with his wife, Gerda, their golden retriever, Anna, and the enduring spirit of their golden Trixie. Here's a little information about The Silent Corner. Quote, "I very much need to be dead," end quote. These are the chilling words left behind by a man who had everything to live for, but took his own life. In the aftermath, his widow, Jane Hawk, does what all her grief, fear, and fury demand: find the truth no matter what. People of talent and accomplishment, people admired and happy and sound of mind, have been committing suicide in surprising numbers in this novel. When Jane seeks to learn why, she becomes the most wanted fugitive in America. Her powerful enemies are protecting a secret so important, so terrifying, that they will exterminate anyone in their way. But all their power and viciousness may not be enough to stop a woman as clever as they are cold-blooded, as relentless as they are ruthless, and who is driven by a righteous rage that they can never comprehend, because it is born of love. When I spoke with Dean Koontz last week, I began by asking him to explain the term The Silent Corner and how he learned about it. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, the silent corner is that place where somebody who's very knowledgeable about being off the grid can live and be. It's not an actual physical place, but it's a way of living that keeps you off the grid. It keeps you in a place where you can use the internet but not be tracked on it, and where you're able to avoid all the various means by which authority can track you these days, which is computers, your cell phone, even some high-end watches have transponders in these days. So the lead character of this book, Jane Hawk, is somebody who lives in the silent corner. She's on the run. She's ultimately the most wanted fugitive in America, and she needs to be as off the grid as these preppers think they are,
yeah,
which most of them aren't.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I loved the way that you were able to
constantly remind us of the silent corner. There's a line early in the book. Do you mind if I read a little something from the book?
Oh, that's fine.
So the line is, she pulled away from the curb, inserting the Ford into a river of vehicles. In nearly every case, each car and SUV and truck and bus was continuously signaling its position for the benefit of commercial collectors of megadata, police agencies, and whoever owned the future. I kind of loved that line anyway, but it also just, there's this constant reminder that we're being watched, we're findable, we're locatable. That's throughout the book.
It's she's in a very dark place, and I thought that would be something fun to write about because it would force me to do a lot of research. And it's funny, when I was a kid in high school and college, I hated doing research. It was the thing I despised the most. So I would make up all my sources in a paper. I'd invent book titles and authors' names and cite them. I shouldn't reveal this to anybody who's in school yet, but I always got away with it. So it became rather amusing to me when I got to be a writer, and slowly over the years, the research became one of the things I most loved doing.
Yeah. Do you find that you spend a lot of time at the library? Are you mostly online doing your research?
I have something like 50,000 to 60,000 books here in the house.
Oh, you do.
And I tend to resort to books or people within the field before I resort online. And in fact, I do not ever go online, but I have two assistants who do. And I can go to them and say, okay, I found all this, but here are some other things I can't track down. And they're able to look them up for me. So the reason I stay off online is actually nothing to do with being tracked or found. It has everything to do with the fact that I know myself to be an obsessive personality. Mm. And were I to start online, I probably would finish writing for the rest of my life.
Yeah, you'd just go down that, you'd go down that rabbit hole, so to speak. But I do know that you have a social media presence. So are your assistants helping you with keeping a social media presence?
I'm always about my publisher. People at my publishing house actually run the Facebook, the website, and all of that. And they ask me for what they need, and I provide it.
So. Okay. All right, great. So I just wondered if the silent corner, or the concept of living off the grid in a silent corner, is where the book started for you.
Actually, no. That came very quickly, but I wanted to write a character, a really good fiction for me as a reader. And as a writer, always centers around character. If the characters work, especially the couple of leads, if they work, then the story works. If they don't work, the story doesn't work very well. And I don't care how whiz-bang the story is, it needs those characters that you have to become involved with.
Right.
And I started out thinking, I'd like to write a novel in which it's relatively short chapters and keeps the pace moving, but at the same time, each chapter would be well-rounded and visualized, and you'd have all your senses involved, and it would center on a woman whom you would very slowly learn some things about. And I started out not knowing anything about her and started learning it as she started revealing a little piece of herself in each little chapter. And I would say by page 25, maybe somewhere in there, I was starting to fall in love with this character. I just her attitude, her situation, and her wit, her intelligence really started to excite me. And that's when other elements of it began to fall together, because I knew that she had lost a husband and that it was suicide, except she didn't believe that for a minute.
Right.
But the sort of what I would call the Michael Crichton-esque element of it, the little bit about science, the cutting-edge science being a threat here. That's just sort of grew up in the early pages of the book.
Okay, Okay. It's funny, you've just hit upon about three different questions I have for you, but I'm going to wait on them. I want to talk first about something that happens or that we learn about. It's already happened off the page, but we learn about early in the book the fact that her husband, Nick, committed suicide very unexpectedly, and his note read, "I very much need to be dead," which, of course, is extremely intriguing. I wondered where in the process of writing the book did his final words come to you?
I think they came to me right in the scene where she needs to repeat them to somebody.
Oh.
It was, I knew the part, once I got to the point that I realized there were going to be many suicides in the background of this book, not necessarily in the front ground, but that there is an epidemic of suicides. And when she begins to investigate her husband's death, she hits upon this discovery that there is this 15% surge in suicides in the country, and they tend to be among people of accomplishment in their field who are happily married or in every other way, the least likely people to kill themselves. And this, when she finds this and begins to look for the reasons of it, that's when she comes under threat and ends up having to go on the run. And so I sort of knew that there was this bigger thing going on out there by the time I got to page 20, 25. But it was in the scene where she sits down to talk to another woman who's lost her husband,
right,
that I started thinking, well, these suicide notes ought to be very different because what's happening here is very different.
Yeah.
And the first one I came up with was his, but then it was... this is kind of macabre, but it got to be kind of fun to come up with various bizarre suicide notes that she refers to later in the story.
Yeah. Now that scene that you just mentioned where she goes to talk to a woman, I'm not going to give away what happens in that scene, but she does have to be very careful as she approaches the house. She's constantly aware that she's being watched and that she may be being followed, or that she doesn't want to be watched. She's constantly concerned that she may be being watched and seen and followed. So, and she kind of has to come up through the backyard to get to that woman's house. You are very good at keeping us in her really concerned mind frame. And actually, it starts, I noticed this before I even knew anything that was going on. There's a moment where I think it's like page 6. She's in the shower, and the line is, "The water was hotter than she expected from a 2-star operation, melting accumulated soreness out of muscle and bone, but she didn't linger in the spray as long as she would have liked." You know, just like so many of these little tiny subtle moments, even before we know where the plot is going, that tell us that she can't linger, you know, she can't, and she, and there's just a lot of, you know, worry about being watched. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how to begin to infuse a narrative with tension, and then as the book progresses, to kind of keep that moving and hold that pace steady.
It's partly it goes back to what I said just a bit ago about characters.
Yes.
You get into the character's head, then you have to stay there, and you have to... this will be something else I'll get to in a minute, but let's
yeah.
talk about how that sense the threat is there and how that leads to constant tension in the book. When she wakes up in the first paragraph, she's for a moment, as sometimes we are, and as she would be in a harried life she's living for the last couple months, she's for just a moment not sure where she is, and then she realizes, oh yes, she's in this motel.
Right.
And it says that there's a gun under the pillow beside her. She always gets a king or queen size bed in a motel, and that's because she is still grieving over her husband. And it's almost that empty side of the bed is for her a way that she always honors him and keeps him to a degree in her life.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that when she goes into the bathroom, she puts that pistol down on the counter, and she's always got the pistol with her, and she looks at the little window in the bathroom and says no one could get through there, not even a child. And then, as you said, she gets in the shower, and you just have to think, what would it be like to know that most of the law enforcement in the country and a lot of very bad people are looking for you?
Mm-hmm.
And once you let a character start to breathe, and you give, it's really important in the opening chapters of a book to establish that character, not just for the reader, but for yourself. And I got from, by the time I got her to the house where she meets the other woman that has lost a husband and wants to talk to her about this, I had come to the understanding that Jane was going to be very tough, what you would call sort of a kick-butt character, but she was going to have this great heart and this tenderness to her. And that, I thought, made her very different from any character like this I've read before.
Yeah.
And when I got to that, then the scenes where you take a breather, where you step back from it, the fact that you look for those little ways to keep the tension going means that even in those scenes where you're just saying, look at this person, wouldn't you like to have her as a friend? Or there's a scene where she, I won't give things away, but it's a rather elaborate sequence in Palisades Park in Santa Monica. And she makes use of locals, like a homeless man who stays there. And she draws people into her plan who are just people of convenience to her. But she pays this homeless man, and she pays in part before the event sequence and at the end. And then there's a scene where, and this time is a thing that when I couldn't have done it when I was young, and that sometimes editors want to cut, but I always make the point, if you want a well-rounded character, you need scenes like this too. And that scene, she just takes that homeless man and sits down with him and talks to him a while. She knows he's lonely, and she goes into a restaurant that wouldn't allow him in and gets him a little food.
Right.
And it's their exchanges that's really, I think that scene cements her for this whole series of books. And there's a lesser scene like that when she sits down to talk to that woman who's lost a husband early in the book, and they start sharing, just as the wives of Marines, because both husbands were Marines. And it's a kind of home, not homely in that kind of sense, but a homey kind of scene,
right?
Because the widow is making muffins to give to friends and is obviously busying herself to get through her grief. And the two of them talking, it isn't all about feeding information or keeping the tension going, but it's also about building that tender side to the character. And once you get all of that going in the character, then it's sustaining it by always being aware of the tension that should be there, but always being aware of that tenderness underlying the toughness, and then letting the character just build. The characters will take over if you start them out strongly enough, and they go places you never anticipate, which for me is the biggest fun about writing, because this character, Jane Hawke, just shocked me again and again.
Oh, that's so funny.
I think she did.
Yeah, no, I have a question about that for you, because I read that you don't outline, and so I wondered if your characters often tend to surprise you in what they do.
Yeah. Jane, especially, she, I think, okay, what am I going to do with her next? And some people say, when I say this, say, no, that doesn't make any sense. You are creating this. She isn't real. So you're directing her there. And I say, no, it is more mysterious than that. If the character really comes alive, a lot of young writers, when they say to me, I get stumped after so far, I can't think what to do with the character, something like that, I try to tell them, don't do anything with the character. Let the character do what the character wants to do. And if you can't get that done, then maybe look at whether your character is strong enough. Do you have enough depth to the character? Do you understand the character fully enough to just start letting go?
Yeah.
And that happens frequently. In Jane's case, one of the things that I love about her character, I've jokingly said twice in my life, I've fallen in love with a woman, and the second one, fortunately, is fictional, so I won't need to hire any attorneys for this. But I just love this character, and she's very real to me. And so there's moments where there's after the first part or so of the book, she goes, she travels north from San Diego, and she ends up in west side of L.A., and she's really putting together a new look for herself. And so she goes shopping a little bit. And so I put her in the short scenes, but she would, it was in some of those conversations that I began to see how kind of sharply witty Jane could be. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting here laughing at some of her dialogue in some of those scenes. And it's like I'm hearing it being spoken to me rather than writing it. And I know this sounds bizarre, but I've talked to some writers that have the same experience. And I think it's my best advice to young writers, if that doesn't start to happen for you at some point where this character wants to do something and you're startled by it, then you've got to go back and rethink the depth of that character.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. Now, I think this is relevant. In a back cover blurb in the book, the Star Ledger calls you the master of edge of your seat paranoid thriller and perhaps the leading American practitioner of the form. And that made me wonder if you're a little bit paranoid, and also if you're not, do you allow yourself a little real paranoia in your actual life in order to better see what your characters might see?
I would say I'm not paranoid, but because true paranoids can't really get a function well in life.
Yeah.
But I've always been able to see the dark side. I think it's because of the way I grew up. My dad was a violent alcoholic, and to the world, he seemed like a hail fellow well met, but he was always ending up in bar fights, and he had 44 jobs in 34 years.
Oh.
And it was as a child I became aware that the way we were very poor, so our life didn't look idyllic from outside, but it didn't look dark from outside as it did from inside. Mm. And so I think I kind of grew up with the realization that there was, could be in the very brightest of all scenes, a darkness within them.
Yeah.
And so I would say, you know, I understand why they say the paranoid fiction, because Jane even says in these books that paranoia, to a degree, is a survival mechanism.
Right. Yeah, it's like stage fright. It's going to help you perform.
That's exactly it, as long as you control it and you don't let it get out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of friends who are police officers, and I always remember one of them who was a chief of police in a town out here, and his wife and my wife and I were having dinner, and I said something about something, and I can't even remember what it was. And I said, I guess that probably sounds a little paranoid. And his wife was a police officer as well. And they both raised their heads and stared at me. and he said, in this world, you can't be paranoid enough. And I thought, well, that's coming from the horse's mouth. You know,
they know
what they're dealing with. But I'm an optimist, so I can't be a total paranoid, but I do see the in life the where darkness intrudes all over, and I think to write suspense, you've got to have a little sense of that.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about the subject of suicide, which is very important in this book. It's a hard subject, even for people without a direct story of a family member or friend. You know, I think most of us know somebody who's been through this or who's had a loved one commit suicide. Do you have any thoughts about how you treat difficult or sensitive subjects when you're writing fiction that might concern them?
Yeah, it's that occurred to me as I was writing it. But the key is you have to write about what you're writing about in an honest way. Don't write about it exploitatively. Don't make the suicide something itself that is an exciting scene.
Right.
You keep the sadness of her situation because she's a widow, Jane, and her husband ostensibly committed suicide, though in fact we learn he didn't.
Right.
But when you're writing about it, you have to keep in mind the seriousness of the subject. There can be a tendency when you're writing, I actually think all writing has to have an element of entertainment. I don't care whether it's literary fiction or whatnot. If you want to read for other than that, then read nonfiction. But even that, you read for entertainment often.
Sure.
So when you're writing something that's aimed at entertaining somebody, you always have to keep in mind, don't make entertainment out of some subject that may be important to the story, but is a very serious matter. The entertainment value has to come from other things that happen in a story. And when you're writing about that, keep it as directly serious and non-exploitative as you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's one reason, for example, that I cannot stand superhero movies. They always end up destroying part of the city to save the rest of it.
Oh, you're right.
And you watch those, and you think, how many hundreds of thousands of people died in this? And you never see one body, of course. And it's very, it chills me often. But I try when there's a subject like this in a book, or for briefly it touches on a subject that has some, you know, solemnity about it, that
yeah.
you stay solemn on it and you don't draw that into the entertainment part of the book.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Just a quick interruption to tell you you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with best-selling suspense author Dean Koontz, whose new novel is The Silent Corner, published by Bantam. If you're enjoying this interview, or if you like to catch the show every week, please consider rating us in iTunes, liking the show on Facebook, tweeting about Write the Book. Social media is, of course, a great way for us to get the word out about the show. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview. We're streaming at 99.3 WBTV.org. I have another section I'd love to read, if you don't mind. It's a little bit longer. Is that okay?
You can read it the rest of the hour if you'd like. I'd love listening to this.
I won't read that long.
Okay.
This is from pretty early in the book. Greener in this season than it would be later in the year. The borderline desert landscape was prized by hikers and nature enthusiasts, thought beautiful by some. To her, it appeared inhospitable, even bleak, as if beyond the windows of the Ford lay a stricken planet struggling under a dying sun. Descending then to Lake Elsinore and beyond, a rural world that seemed isolate, lush meadows and valley scrub, private graveled and oiled lanes leading to properties tucked back from the state route, small and separate groves of cottonwoods and conifers testifying to an aquifer under land that would have been otherwise hard scrabble. First of all, I very much admire your descriptions of setting, and I wanted to ask you about that. But also, I just really love when an author does a good job of letting a setting reflect a character's state of mind. And I feel like you've done that so well here. You know, she is struggling. She is stricken. She is struggling. And those words show up in what she sees of this world that other people think is beautiful. I just thought that was a really lovely moment. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about writing setting.
Yeah, I just spent a couple of hours with at a college here, a creative writing class, and one thing I say often is, look, Ernest Hemingway created a whole new voice in fiction that was a divide from everything that came before it, but until he became, you know, a serious alcoholic, that fiction was not as simple as it appeared to be. There was depth to it. But what has happened is that if there is a voice that's been mimicked and inspired, or let's be generous and say inspired other writers more than anybody else in the past century, it was Hemingway. And I find it unfortunate that so many modern writers have abandoned metaphor and simile. Figures of speech have largely disappeared in favor of this, what they think is this better way of telling a story, but they give away all these wonderful tools that this beautiful language allows them. And one of those tools is to be able to do with landscape, with any setting, reflecting the character's state of mind, because every scene is should be through one character's point of view.
Right.
Sometimes it's the villain, sometimes it's the lead character. And if the landscape or the room, and it doesn't mean you have to design a place that is bleak, it's just how, just as you read there, as the character sees it, she acknowledges that there's people who see this as beautiful, but she does not. You set a mood through description that can't be done otherwise. And it also helps to establish a character's set of mind. I'm happy when I get a review. We had one from Pittsburgh Post-Gazette that was lovely on this book. And it touches upon this very thing about use of language and so forth. And if you're writing from within the point of view of the character in the scene, and you switch to another, that character is going to notice things also, and describe scenes, but it's going to be described in a different way,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to be from that character's point of view. And this is something I love, and I think has been lost, unfortunately, in a lot of fiction, where it is the supposedly better, but I don't feel that way. I don't feel that more is better, so that you end up with a 1,000-page book. But if you can describe things with a language that's actually fun to read in
mm-hmm.
itself, then it also just, as you pointed out, helps establish the character and the mood and everything in ways that otherwise are almost impossible to get done.
Yeah, okay. How many books have you written?
I stopped counting years ago.
That's so funny.
I think it's over 120.
Wow.
And people go, oh, my. But I point out Henry James wrote 120-some books.
Yeah.
And so I'm just trying to catch up to Henry James.
There you go. So, okay, at this point, I really want to know, you know, a little bit about your writing practice and your schedule. I don't always ask people about their writing schedules. I don't think it's that interesting in most cases, but I think it might be interesting in your case.
Well, it's funny. Somebody, and this was very sweet, she said that somebody in my professional life, I won't identify her exactly, but because she works with a lot of writers, but just out of nowhere on this book this time, said to me, you know, every other writer I know writes to live. You live to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there is some truth in that, because I did this for years before I was a bestseller, and it was a struggle, and you would have thought, might as well give this up. It's never going to work. But so I love this. It's hard work, but at the same time, I love what I'm doing, and there's also play in it. And so I'm up at 5, some mornings at 4:30. I get my shower, well, usually walk the dog first and feed the dog, then shower, and I'm in my office by 6:15, 6:30, and I work straight through the dinner. I do not take lunch maybe a dozen times a year when it's with somebody, but if I eat lunch, I get kind of slow-witted. So breakfast and dinner. So I put in, I'll generally put in a 9 to 10 hour day, and I will do that 6 days a week.
Wow.
And then as we get toward the final stages of the book, the last third, I often ramp up to 70 and 80 hour weeks, and sometimes more. That's because when I'm lost in the book, when it's a very big part of my day of being in a room alone, working on this, I fall away into the story. It all becomes more real to me, and that facilitates maintaining the excitement. The latter third of a book should always start accelerating so that nobody can stop reading. And in order to do that, I have to put in those long hours. So I work a lot, but it's also kind of like play to me. So if I wasn't doing this, as I sometimes said, I would just be getting in trouble with the cops. So why not sit here?
That's wonderful that you still love it so much. I mean, you are
one of, I'm sure, the top-selling authors in this country, and I would think that would put enormous pressure on you. But it sounds like that's not affecting your motivation or output necessarily as much as your joy in the craft. Is that overstating it? Or
no, that's pretty much it. I've been so fortunate. Somebody, my publisher in England said, "Wow, look at this," and sent me some chart of all-time best-selling writers, and they had me at number 11,
wow,
just behind Tolstoy. And I said, "Damn! Now I have a goal."
Henry James anymore.
I could have stopped if it was about money or anything else. I could have stopped it a long time ago, but it isn't about that. It's when you're working as long as I've worked at this. Now I have to tell another little story about how stupid I was when I was young. So those stories are infinite in number, but I'll only give you one.
Okay.
I thought when I was very young, I thought, okay, when I've written 10 or 12 books, I've learned all the tricks, and then this will get easy. Well, of course, the number of quote-unquote tricks are infinite, and the thing I find fascinating about it is the longer you do it, the more things it occurs to you to do that will test whether you can pull it off. And that's the great fun of it, seeing if you are going to fall on your face or whether you can pull this thing off that you want to do. And the older I've gotten, more complicated those things are that I want to pull off, and the more interesting it all gets. So I may have lost track of your question, but I think that is part of the answer.
No, that's absolutely relevant. Now, the first of your books that I ever experienced was actually also my first time listening to an audiobook, which is a while ago now. I love listening to audiobooks, and I do that regularly. I was going on a trip. I was going to be driving for a couple days, and I got The Watchers. Mm-hmm. And that really took me on my ride very easily. I was just moving right along. So I wondered if you ever listen to your own books, or do you at least just dip in to hear what the speaker's voices are like?
I get to pick the narrator for the book. I don't know that I'm so good at that. What they do is give me three or four that they think are likely best readers for it, and then I listen to them, and then I pick one. But it's very strange. I have never gone back after it's been recorded to listen to one.
Interesting.
I will listen to when it comes time for the next one, and they give me a sample. For instance, if it's a series like my Odd Thomas series, and they've had one reader on for a couple of books and say, "You want to listen to a little bit of the last one, be sure this is still the character," then I'll listen to it that way. But I don't know why that is, but maybe it's because I'm never really in a place to listen to audio. I don't drive to and from work. I walk down the hallway.
Yeah, right.
and that doesn't allow me much time to be listening to audio. Fortunately, my wife is the same way. We're very much homebodies. We're not big travelers. Our idea of a good time is to have friends in or to spend time together with the dog. So we're not usually in places we can listen to audio, but it's a wonderful form. I know that because it keeps expanding and growing.
Yeah, it is. I really enjoy it. All right, let's return specifically to The Silent Corner. So, of course, part of what upped the stakes for me was learning that Nick and Jane have a little boy named Travis, and part of her struggle is to maintain his safety, you know, sort of above everything else. So, you know, this may be a kind of obvious question, but I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about what it does for a novel of suspense to give your character something vital to protect, and maybe not even as vital as a little boy, but just like they have to have something that they want to keep safe or something that they want. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. That's part and parcel of what I'm talking about earlier about character.
Mm-hmm.
I can't write a story in which all it is the character has to just save the world from a nuclear blast that's going to go off in Sacramento or something.
Right.
That kind of story can be thrilling, but And the way the characters are often dealt with in that is they have some kind of personal thing, like they're fighting alcoholism or, you know, this, that, or the other thing. I don't really find that compelling.
Mm-hmm.
What I find compelling is that the character will have problems that are really fundamentally complicate the other thing the character needs to do, the central driving thing in the story, which is, in her case, she wants to know why her husband died. And if he didn't kill himself, how was he killed? Who did kill him? And what is going on here? And while she's trying to find that out, you come to a moment in the book where she's taking a detour, what seems to be a detour. She's turning inland off the coast highway, and she says she's going to the most important place in the world,
which
means to her. And that's when you find out this isn't giving too much away to
anybody. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to bring up something that would spoil anything, but...
Yeah, it's fairly early in the book,
yeah.
And the moment you realize that there's a child involved here, and he's 5 years old, and to her, he looks like her husband, so there's even this further emotional situation, and that once she started to uncover this conspiracy, they not only threatened her, but they threatened her child, and in a very dramatic way that you see subsequently, and that ups the stakes dramatically, because it's not just can she break this conspiracy, but what happens to Jane if something happens to her son, because
right.
that's the end all and be all for her in this. And when I started this, I didn't know I was writing a series, but I'm now on book 4.
Oh, wow.
And book 2, in my mind, and also to my publisher's mind, is better than book 1. And book 3, I was delighted with, and now I'm in book 4. And the situation with the son becomes very important in book 4. And I'm now seeing that Jane is probably going to occupy me for years, and that the first story arc is 7 books. And... we just concluded a deal for all of that, and
she, and
it's because of all this emotional content. I've been happy to see some reviews talk about the book being full of not just excitement but emotion, and that helps the suspense. If you want to write suspense, you really need to connect with those characters. And if you connect, you're going to have an emotional connection, and it helps if you see the character having genuine emotion. It has to be restrained. You know, we don't want sobby sort of, you know. In fact, it's more effective if it's restrained. There's a moment when she leaves the boy. She goes to visit the boy with these people she's entrusted him to that she doesn't think anybody can find. And she has to leave him because she has to go on. And that moment is played quietly,
mm-hmm.
but it's more affecting for being played quietly.
So, absolutely.
Yeah, if the character has something big to lose personally, and in this case, Jane has not only the child, but probably her own self-respect, her own willingness to go on if anything were happening to the boy. So the stakes go up much higher. The tension is increased that way.
Yeah, great. So one very real societal issue that you address in this book is the spectacle of television reporting, specifically of tragic events. They use the term disaster porn to describe this sometimes. And actually, there's been a really recent example of this with the immigrant workers who were recently found dead in a Walmart parking lot. And I've just been seeing it everywhere on the Weather Channel, on this loop, over and over and over. And, you know, what does that have to do with the weather? But anyway, I wonder if you can talk about this phenomenon a little bit.
Yeah, it's Jane's going to become sort of a target of this. By the time she's at the end of book 1, she is the most wanted fugitive in the United States. She's an FBI agent who took a leave after her husband's suicide.
Right.
But then went beyond leave. She went rogue, and she becomes enormously wanted. And I'm trying to think if it's book 3 or maybe in book 4, there's a television special about her called The Beautiful Monster.
Ah.
because, you know, she's being accused of all these crimes she actually hasn't committed. And when she's killed, it's been in self-defense against some very bad people, but that isn't the way it's being portrayed by the people who are after her. And so this became, I didn't really intend it, it became sort of a, it's one of those things that grow up as you're writing the book.
Yeah.
And I realized that there's even very early on, she's in the first volume, she's having lunch in a sort of bar restaurant before she moves on to the next bit of excitement she gets into. And there's a reporter in the bar, and there's been a terrorist incident in Philadelphia, and the reporter's just walking around talking to people, and she has a conversation with him about that. And it's sort of acerbic in her part, and some people involved with the television thing on this, when they read it, they said to me, "We fell in love with her in that scene because of her attitude." And I thought, yeah, I can't peg exactly when I fell in love with her, but it has a lot to do with her attitude. And one of it is this sort of cynicism about this very thing, how in our media-saturated world, where you've got all this 24-hour-day cable news, they're always looking for the sensational because that's what draws eyes.
Right.
And it, I think it gives us a twisted view of the world because you're not seeing much of what average life is going on in the world, or you're not seeing, there's a tendency to, only unless they, it's a little piece they often do toward the end of a show where it's puppies for rescue or
right.
some touching story about, a child surviving this. But the rest of it will all be this negative stuff. And it's because negativity and tragedy and disaster draws more eyes.
Yeah.
And there's something twisted about that, that you wonder what that does to a culture over a period of time. We're living in the first time that was ever possible until media could, everybody could be looking at the same media from one end of the country to the other in real time. We never were in a place in history where this kind of thing was possible until the last maybe 50 years. And it's just getting more and more that way, and it's disturbing. So that becomes sort of an element in the book.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's trying to be a book about our times, and there's a central thing in it, the Michael Crichton-esque element, which has a little bit to do with an existing technology. And I want the books in this series to be really reflective of the world people know and see every day.
Yeah.
And being almost a chronicle of our times in many ways. But this sort of scientific element in it, I was thinking, boy, I wonder, there will probably be a few readers who say, now that sort of goes over the top. And then just 6 weeks before this book came out, Elon Musk announced he was forming a company, mm-hmm. $1.3 billion, to do something very similar,
yeah.
Although with the high ideals in mind. But at some point in talking about it, he says, and all of this will be focused on making us think better.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went, uh-oh.
Okay. I have just one last question for you, Dean. And it has to do with, you just mentioned bad people. It has to do with writing villains or antagonists, bad guys. The radio show that I host is for writers as well as readers. And so I was wondering if we can finish up with some advice for writers who might be listening. It strikes me that no matter what genre you work in, your writing studies good and evil in some form. And I wondered if you might be able to offer advice on approaching writing the darker side or darker characters.
When I'm writing about people who are, we would call them villains or the antagonists of the novel, I want to show that, which I think is, it's absolutely true, it comes out of my worldview, that doing evil is not rational. Evil doesn't work as a model for your life. It may appear to, mm-hmm. that there are some criminal types and so on, but they all end badly one way or the other.
Yeah.
And so I sort of say all evil people are mentally ill. Not all mentally ill people are evil. Mm-hmm. And when I'm writing a character and I want you to see the evil in them, I have a rule to myself that you do not glamorize evil. You don't take the villain and make him so alluring that it's kind of a version of Dracula, and because there's something that makes me queasy about that.
Yeah.
So I tend to, when I'm within a villain's persona, I always make sure I quietly show you the irrationality of it. And a lot of times I do that by making him somewhat a figure of amusement.
Mm.
And that still allows the villain to be very villainous. But at the same time, it takes away that possibility that you're creating an anti-hero here that is socially destructive to make people admire a character like that or be interested in a character like that. And I found that approach to writing about evil good. And I think in that case, it comes out of my dad, too, because my dad, while childhood was very dark because of him, I was not an unhappy child because I could always find something to make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
And partly it was avoiding him, and partly it was escaping into books. But I also have always been able to see there was something very funny about him. He was an inventor, too, who could get people to put up money to develop his inventions, and significant sums, all of which he would drink away, squander away, chasing women. And he would have investors howling because it was all stolen, and we never saw a dime of it. And if somebody invested, say, this is many years ago, so it would be more than now, invested $40,000 in it, which maybe is like $400,000 today, that money would be gone in 2 weeks or whatever, and he might produce a couple of samples of the things. But his inventions were all ludicrous, and it always amazed me that people were so foolish as to put money in them anyway. When I do public speaking, I sometimes talk about that, and when I tell people in the audience about his inventions, it always gets huge laughter because it seems so foolish. And I think that's where maybe from childhood I got to see that in doing the wrong thing, there is often shows it's not just a defect in the character, it's a defect in reasoning and logic that can often be as amusing as it is terrifying. And that's one thing I bring to writing about villains that make them, for me, more rounded.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. That's really good advice. You know, and I also liked before what you said about the scene where Jane is meeting with that woman, and the kind of like quieter, softer side of Jane gives us a kind of lull in the suspense that brings the suspense back so much more fully. And in the same way, just sort of like instilling within the dark characters a sort of humorous, or it's almost like the contrast of these things helps round them out and keep them from becoming cliche, if that makes sense.
Exactly.
That's what it sounds like.
One of the ones that the character that people keep bringing back to me it's the villain, it's beyond villainous, it's monstrous. That's the in Watchers, which you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
The wonderful dog, and then there's this other creature from a laboratory and what made that work, I think, was you eventually, while you're terrified of this thing that's after the dog, because it's been developed as a biological weapon, a kind of laboratory-made soldier, inhuman in every aspect, and yet you come to pity it by the end of the story. And it's not often you're asked to pity a villain, and I would be very careful about doing that with a human villain, but in this case, it was the same thing. It brought more roundness to that creature.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, great. I want to just mention again the name of the title of the book is The Silent Corner, a novel of suspense, written by Dean Kuntz and published by Bantam. Dean Kuntz, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really, really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. It was easy. It's not always easy. It depends on the questioner, too.
Well, thank you.
You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with best-selling suspense author Dean Kuntz. His new series features Jane Hawke. And the next book in that series will be The Whispering Room. Again, I assume published by Bantam. You can read more about his work and the Jane Hawke series at deankuntz.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the conversation that you just heard with my guest, Dean Kuntz. Early in Dean's new book, the reader encounters the definition of the term silent corner. Quote, those who are truly off the grid and cannot be tracked by any technology, yet are able to move about freely and use the internet, are said to be in the silent corner. Reading this book made me think a lot about how much of our activity is tracked or can be. ATM and debit cards, credit cards, GPS technology, security cameras, and certainly smartphones are all eminently capable of tracking our actions and movements. How do you feel about that? Does it make you feel at risk or safe? Write a short story, an essay, or a poem using your reaction to this phenomenon as a starting point. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And then you can, as I already said, access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. Stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org. That's every Monday at 3. When we are broadcasting, it will be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know. If you have a guest to suggest, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. Next week, the show features two Vermonters who work to bring us children's books. First, Vermont author Lita Schubert, who has a new children's picture book about Pete Seeger called Listen, How Pete Seeger Got America Singing. That's illustrated by Raul Colon and published by Roaring Brook Press. And in the second hour of the show, I will be speaking with Vermont illustrator Amy Huntington, whose latest book is Fresh Picked Poetry, A Day at the Farmer's Market. And she illustrated the book, and the author who wrote the words is Michelle Schaub. And that's published by Charles Bridge. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you have been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you have a great week.